It's Veterans Day week. Actor and philanthropist Gary Sinise joins me to share the way his foundation is helping veterans and their new milestone. How is the Chinese Communist government exerting its influence here in the U.S.? After striking a trade deal with President Trump, foreign policy expert Gordon Chang is here with an update. And the U.S. bishops gathered in Baltimore for their annual fall meeting. And, of course, synodality and immigration were both on the menu. Here with reaction and analysis, theologian and blogger Patrick Nevy. The World Over begins right now.
Now, Raymond Arroyo.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you this week. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo and always at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. We just celebrated Veterans Day here in the U.S., and my next guest is celebrating a milestone for his foundation. Here to share this wonderful story, please welcome back to the program, Gary Sinise. Gary, always a pleasure to see you. I wanted to have you on this week to talk about this milestone in the work of your Gary Sinise Foundation, which is happening on November 19th. Tell us what it is.
Thank you, Raymond. We have a wonderful program at the Gary Sinise Foundation called RISE. It stands for Restoring Independence, Supporting Empowerment. And this is a home building program for badly wounded service members. We build these smart technology, mortgage-free, specially adapted houses for, you know, people that have been very, very badly wounded. And I've been doing this now since 2010. I started raising money to build specially adapted housing before I even had the Gary Sinise Foundation. So The milestone you're talking about right now goes back to 2010. And between 2010 and November 19th, this will be our 100th home that we've provided.
Wow.
For somebody who's been very, very severely wounded or injured serving our military.
Gary, tell me about the recipient of this 100th home, retired U.S. Army Sergeant First Class Joseph Bowser. Tell me about him, and why do you think these homes, these smart homes, are so important to these men? What do they tell you?
Well, they can change lives, not only for the service member, but for the family. What we're trying to do is provide technology in the home, wider doorways, bathrooms, kitchens, everything specifically designed to provide independence and empower the service member to be free within his home. You know, if you're living in a house that's not designed for a wheelchair or, you know, severe burns, difficulties that somebody might have, maybe they're paralyzed or something like that, living in that home could be very challenging. So we specifically design each one of these houses based on the needs of each service member. And Joe was, it's 20 years ago, lost a leg. I was actually at the base, visiting the base, not when he got injured, but I had been to the base that he was injured on. It was called Camp Anaconda in Balad, Iraq. He was serving there, and a mortar round came in, and when he was walking across the base, and boom, it knocked him down, and he lost a leg. I met him, not too long after he was injured, and we became friends. He never asked for anything, you know, in all this time. He got, you know, his prosthetic. He was playing hockey. He was a younger guy at that time. And as time has gone on, he's gotten older. Things are a bit more challenging. He reached out to us, and I was all too happy to set my team on working with him and designing his special home. And next week he's going to move into it with his wife, Michelle. They've been through a lot. They're a great, great, great group of people there. We love them dearly. And I'll be attending the dedication next week.
I love it. Well, I also love that you all tailor the homes. It's not a one size fits all. You tailor it to the needs of that particular serviceman or woman. And in this case, Joe, you know, gets a house that can accommodate his particular challenges, his particular difficulties. So God bless you all for that. I think it's such important and great work you do. In our polarized culture, Gary, supporting the military, especially those who are severely injured and have sacrificed so much for the nation, it seems that everybody can put aside their ideological differences and come together in at least that moment to care for our military and first responders. Are you seeing that, particularly as the political culture gets more heated around us?
We have a lot of support. I mean, when you think about it, Raymond, post September 11th, there were thousands of nonprofits that started to pop up. People that just wanted to do something, to take action, to help our service members through difficult times. And remember, Afghanistan and the early part of the Iraq War, there were a lot of wounded in action and a lot of killed in action during this period of time. At one point, the hospitals, Walter Reed, was so full, they had people in the hallways. And it was a very, very challenging time. So we had a lot of people that were surviving injuries today based on the battlefield medicine and medical experience of our service members who are taking care of these folks, so that years ago they wouldn't have survived these injuries. So we have a lot of wounded from the Afghanistan and Iraq wars. And we have a lot of people that are reaching out to try to do something to help. We have all kinds of folks supporting the Gary Sinise Foundation and the work that we do there. We have multiple programs that we're addressing multiple needs. I think we have those programs because I was doing a lot of support work with various nonprofits that were in multiple different spaces before I had my foundation. So when I started my foundation, we wanted to be of service in many different areas. And I find that we have, there are a lot of people out there that are supportive. I think we learned some hard lessons from what happened to our Vietnam veterans when they came home. That was a challenging time. It was a divided time in our nation. And the service member returning from war fell through the cracks, and we treated them badly. I don't think there are a lot of people that don't want that to happen again, and I'm certainly one of those.
Well, and another issue that you all are really on the forefront of and that we often forget is the epidemic of suicides and PTSD among our returning veterans. I mean, the rate of suicides is 1.5% higher for veterans than non-vets. And that translates, by the way, Gary, I read this statistic. I almost couldn't believe it. That's an average of about 17 deaths a day. And I know you and the foundation are very concerned about this issue. What are you all doing to ease veterans' transition and civilian life and really support them in their mental health once they get home?
I'm glad you raised that, Raymond. That's a very, very difficult challenge because quite often, how often have you heard, that somebody decides that that's the only way out, to take their own life? Mm-hmm. And then you talk to their family and friends and they say, we had no idea. We didn't see any signs. You never let on. I mean, that has happened multiple times. So battle buddies, I think, are the peer-to-peer work from people that served with different members of the military. I think they can play a huge role in just reaching out to buddies who they've served with to just check on them. Find out if they're okay. Quite often they won't say if there's any problem. But maybe, somewhere along the line, they see somebody they know, they recognize from television or movies or something like that, talking about the services that are available to them if they're going through difficult times. And hopefully they will take the initiative to reach out and get those services. Services are available. At the Gary Sinise Foundation, we have many mental wellness initiatives. One of those things is we have, years ago, I was involved in executive producing a movie called Brothers at War. It's a documentary that showed military life. A buddy of mine followed his two brothers around in Iraq, and then when they came home and how it was like for them to reintegrate with the family. Mm-hmm. It It was active duty military life. We decided to make a follow-up film to that called Brothers After War, where we looked at the people that we met in that first movie to find out how they are doing. Many of them had transitioned out of the military and were now veterans. And we wanted to talk to them about what it was like to return home from war, to get out of the military and move on with life. And now we're using that movie as a means to get people to express themselves, to talk about what they're going through. You watch this movie and you watch the veterans in the movie, Brothers After War, talking about what it was like to come home. And that content, you know, when you see these people sharing their stories on screen in a big room filled with veterans, there may be a lot of veterans that haven't expressed themselves like that. And maybe that movie opens the doors. And we do workshops with veterans. I would encourage people to look up Brothers After War. We provide these workshops. We're trying to be as proactive as possible to reach out to people before they make that decision, that wrong decision, that decision we don't want them to make. There are services. We want them to know that we care about them. We just have to be proactive wherever we can. And the more nonprofits that are in this space, the better. And the more the VA can do, the better. We all have to work together to solve that suicide problem. We don't want that to happen to somebody who served our country.
No, we don't. God bless all those men and women. And, you know, the heavy price, not only they pay on the battlefield, but when they get home, you know, the wounds they carry with them. And I'm delighted. It's so important that you're focused on that. Before I let you go, we have reported on and talked about your late son, Mac, on this show multiple times, his music, his legacy. Last Sunday, the president's own Marine Band performed Mac's Arctic Circles, one of his compositions, at the National Cathedral in D.C. It was part of the Marine Corps birthday service. I want to play a little bit of that and then get your reaction. Gary, you were there. What did you think when you were hearing that?
Oh, well, you can imagine, Raymond. I mean, first of all, it's a beautiful piece of music. You know that music well. Mm-hmm. I can't hear it without tearing up and remembering what it was like to be with Mac at the recording session when the orchestra was playing that music. And the president's own Marine Corps band reached out to me and said that they wanted to play it the night before the Marine Corps birthday at the National Cathedral. I was knocked out by that. So, of course, I was going to go. And I went to the National Cathedral that day with Oliver Schnee, who's Mac's producing partner and composing buddy. We went together, and we were standing there listening to the music. And I got to tell you, it was something. I have a cell phone video that Kristen, who's worked for me, she's a Marine herself, and she came with me. Yeah. She was doing a cell phone video watching us watch the orchestra play that music. Mm. And it was something. And the great thing about it is more orchestras around the country are discovering the music, and they're reaching out to me and wanting to play it. And now I'm working on a third record, Raymond, of other music.
Yeah, I knew that. That's exciting. Where did you find the other music? Where was it?
In his files. I mean, I thought when I did the part two. I did Resurrection and Revival part two after Mac died, and I found all this music. I thought I'd found everything. And I came on your show, and we played some of it. And now I'm going to have to come on again, Raymond, because we got part three coming up. I found a whole bunch more music, and it's beautiful.
Wow. Well, Gary, you're welcome back anytime. We will leave it there. God bless you and the great work you're doing. For more on the work of the Gary Sinise Foundation, on behalf of our nation's military men and women, visit GarySiniseFoundation.org. Gary, thank you. Talk soon.
Thank you, Raymond.
The trade deal between the U.S. and China struck in October took effect this week. Will the trade truce hold? Joining me to discuss all of this, author and foreign policy expert Gordon Chang. Gordon, thanks for being here. The Wall Street Journal reported on Monday that China plans to ease the flow of rare earths and other restricted materials to the U.S. via a system that will exclude companies with ties to the U.S. military, while fast-tracking export approvals for other firms. What do we know about this move, and how is the Trump administration responding?
We don't know very much beyond what was reported in the Journal. There have been a number of rumors to that effect. The Trump administration hasn't responded at all. We know that there are various versions of what President Trump and President Xi Jinping agreed to on October 30, but none of those versions would permit what you talked about, which is the exclusion of sales to defense-related contractors. So this appears to be a violation of that agreement. Now, also, we're seeing problems with China's purchases of soybeans. There apparently were agreements as to how much the Chinese would be buying, and it does not appear that they will meet their commitments for this year. So we have problems across the board with that agreement.
How have the U.S.'s use of tariffs under Trump actually protected U.S. security and gotten the Chinese to the table? I know the Supreme Court's reviewing whether he has the constitutional authority to actually enact these tariffs on his own.
Yeah. Well, certainly it was the tariffs that got the Chinese to talk. So, for instance, the 20% additional tariff on fentanyl is, I think, the only reason why they had those discussions with both President Trump and FBI Director Kash Patel. And clearly the Chinese, I think, responded to all sorts of trade barriers that President Trump had put into place. Now, unfortunately, we're seeing those barriers being taken down before the Chinese comply with their agreements, and this is not good for the United States. We've gone through this before. As a matter of fact, President Trump went through this before. He had the January 2020 Phase One trade deal, which the Chinese violated almost immediately after it was inked. The Chinese are doing the same thing now, and so this doesn't look good. That's not to say that things are going to go bad, but it is to say that the first indications are that the Chinese are again dishonoring a trade pact with the United States.
Yeah, I mean, this is kind of the de facto position of the Chinese. They agree to something and then violate it before the signature is dry. I mean, it's pretty typical. You recently reported and shared on social media that a source in Korea informed you that China's trying to get the Korean government to censor speech. How is China attempting this, Gordon?
Well, Yi Jae-myung, the new president of South Korea, is very pro-China. And we know that the Chinese diplomats have actually talked to Yi's government publicly and privately and said that they felt that these statements have been made, anti-CCP statements, as they're called, are outside the bounds of free speech in Korea. And the Korean government agrees. So it didn't take very much for China to persuade Yi Jae-myung to try to stop anti-China, quote-unquote, conversations. This means basically the end of free speech in South Korea. This is at the same time, Raymond, that Yi is attacking other democratic institutions. He's jailing pastors. He's jailing political opponents. This looks like a slide not only to authoritarianism, but it could very well be a slide to full totalitarianism, because we know that many of Yi's closest advisors are basically communists.
Well, former South Korean President Yoon was removed from office in April. He's now detained while awaiting trial for his failed attempt to impose martial law. Gordon, I guess my question is, what's the latest on that situation? And why is it critical for Yoon to be released?
Well, Yoon was, first of all, not only removed as president, he was also charged with insurrection, which is the only crime that he could be charged with, or it was one of two crimes. And then on Monday, he was charged with the other crime, which was aiding the enemy. Also this week, police officers, about 100 of them, armed with search and arrest warrants, took into custody the former prime minister of South Korea. So this looks like a full-scale assault on opposition figures. And really what this means is that Yoon is being held on bogus charges. He's probably going to die in jail or die in custody because he's been denied medical care. So this is inhumane treatment. This is an attempt to kill opposition members.
Wow. In an interview with Fox News with my colleague Laura Ingraham this week, President Trump doubled down on his plan to allow 600,000 Chinese student visas despite backlash. Gordon, we've talked about the potential harm of this before. Why is the president so determined, do you think, to allow these 600,000 individuals, which could very well be spies for China, or a portion of them could be, into the United States?
Well, now you're really trying to get me angry, Raymond, if I have to answer that question. I don't know what's in President Trump's mind. He actually said, you know, this is good for our economy. This is good for the schools involved. Yes, but he didn't talk about two things. One of them, of course, is that every place that is taken by Chinese student or Indian student, for that matter, is one fewer place for an American. And we know that the Chinese are disproportionately taking STEM seats, science, technology, engineering, mathematics, which means that we're not teaching our kids in the skills that are necessary for the 21st century. We also know that the Chinese have these networks of consular officials and Ministry of State security agents that monitor, coerce, and surveil Chinese students. And they do that to force Chinese students to commit espionage, as well as to try to intimidate, get the Chinese students to intimidate other students into not exercising their First Amendment rights. So this is a very bad story. The president is 100% wrong. And I'm, you know, we saw Laura Ingraham in that extraordinary interview. She didn't even let Trump speak. She was so angry. And you never really see that anywhere, especially not from a conservative leaning anchor. But she's absolutely right. She's a hero, Raymond. She's a hero.
Yeah, well, that interview was filled with sparks. Sparks were flying, something else. China has the largest and longest distance fishing fleet in the world, Gordon. Another area where we see them intruding into international waters, something like almost 1,500 vessels. My question is, your thoughts on the overfishing in these international waters. I'm told by people this is happening in Alaska. How are they using this fishing fleet to exert dominance in these international waters?
China has over 500,000 of these fishing vessels.
And a half million? These are
over 500,000. And they engage in IUU fishing, illegal, unreported, unregulated fishing. And they do it against the United States in Alaskan waters, as you just mentioned. And they do it against other countries, many other countries. Argentina is now the big issue. But it's, you know, Raymond, it's not just in international waters. They have a right to be there. They have a right to fish those waters. They don't have a right to fish in the exclusive economic zones of other countries. That's the band of water between 200 nautical miles and 12 nautical miles from a shoreline. The Chinese fish EEZ waters. They have no right to do that. And in Argentina, where the most recent sighting of the Chinese fishing fleets, the U.S. Coast Guard actually cooperates and works with the Argentinian Coast Guard to protect Argentinian waters. but we know that there have been incidents in the past. The Indonesians have actually seized and sunk Chinese fishing vessels, and that has worked a little bit to prevent the Chinese from intruding on Indonesia's waters.
Hmm. A Chinese envoy made a barely veiled beheading threat against Japan's new prime minister, Takeuchi, this past week. In a now-deleted post, the envoy from Beijing called for the new PM's death. Your reaction to this, Gordon, what's happening here? Why would they do such a thing?
Well, Takeuchi before that said that if China were to invade Taiwan, Japan would have to mobilize, which, of course, is common sense. And the Chinese didn't like that. And so we had the Osaka General Council threaten to behead her. But we've got to remember that this general counsel also threatened to cut off the head of Pete Hegseth. So this is conduct which the international community has tolerated. And because it's tolerated, the Chinese felt that they could continue with this. But we have seen from other Chinese diplomats comments that are basically in the same vein. And so we have got to stop treating China as a legitimate state. That's a long conversation, but we know that China will do whatever we permit it to do. So, yes, they are the villains, but we've permitted them to be villains. And this is on us as well as them.
Gordon, a few weeks ago, there was a horrific stabbing on a train in the UK, resulting in at least 10 people injured. And the perpetrator was linked to additional knife attacks before these train stabbings. Now, I know these things are occurring throughout the UK on individuals. What is driving these attacks? And what about terror cells? Not only there, but here in the homeland.
Well, we know that there are terror cells in the homeland, to take your last point. You know, some people say that they're in every zip code. I'm not sure that's the case. But nonetheless, we know that they are large and well organized. And in some places, such as in San Francisco and in New York, they are above ground. And they're also above ground on some of our campuses. So this is really serious. We know that there have been dangerous elements coming across both the northern and southern borders. We've got to be extremely concerned. This has occurred at the same time that there's been an increase in the tempo of incursions by Chinese nationals into our military bases, also illegal surveillance of those bases by Chinese nationals. We found that secret Chinese biological weapons lab in Reedley, California, that alert building inspector in December 2022. Inside, they had at least 20 pathogens, some of them for fatal diseases, as well as almost 1,000 mice genetically engineered to spread disease. Wow. We know that they're here, and we also know that both the Biden and Trump administrations have not worked with the vigor necessary to take them apart. You know, if I can just go on for one more second.
Yeah, sure.
You know, I love Tom Holman, but, you know, he needs to devote ICE agents to breaking up the Chinese networks, not going after the people in the Home Depot parking lots. Yes, nobody who is illegal should remain in the U.S., but there needs to be a priority. We need to start taking out those who mean to kill Americans. Those who mean to improve your kitchen, yeah, they got to go, but they're not the priority.
Hmm. Socialist candidate Zohran Mamdani won the election of New York mayor last week. His win was acclaimed by the Muslim community as well as progressive Democrats. How does China see the Mamdani win, do you think, Gordon?
Well, China financed it. We know that through a number of different channels, especially through the Communist Party's United Front Work Department, they've been funneling money to Mamdani's campaign and to the campaign of other leftists. And we also know that China has been fomenting violence on American streets. And here again, we know about this, Raymond. We don't take adequate measures to stop it. This is our country. If we lose it, it's, you know, it's going to be our fault. So I can't stress enough. This is a bipartisan failure. Republicans and Democrats, liberals and conservatives have all failed to protect the United States against a known danger. We are repeating the same dynamic that was in the 1990s with regard to Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. We know how that one turned out. So we have no excuse. We've got no excuse for not dealing with this. And Americans should be outraged at the Chinese, but they should also be outraged at the people that they elected to protect them who are not protecting them.
Gordon, we will leave it there. For all the latest reports and analysis from Gordon Chang, you can follow him on X at Gordon G. Chang. Thank you, Gordon.
Thank you, Raymond.
Over on the Arroyo Grande podcast, I sat down with Daily Wire's Michael Knowles this week for a wide-ranging discussion about art, faith, the battle over truth in today's toxic culture. We also talked about his eye-opening new documentary on the wartime Pope Pius XII and his real record. I was going to ask you about that, the inexplicable banning and shunning and shaming of people, young and old, who love the old rite, love the traditional Latin Mass, and they're treated like lepers, or worse, treated like pagans. You can't even come into the parish anymore.
Yes.
There's a huge disconnect there. At a time when everyone's saying we should be synodal and listen and walk with everybody, yet here are your most fervent believers, the people who want to be there unlike anybody else, and you basically lock the door in their faces.
Yes, I sure would love a little accompaniment, ecumenism maybe for that. But I totally understand why, in the wake of the Second Vatican Council, the reform came about. Let's not forget, you know, what became the Mass of Paul VI was not an essential part of the Second Vatican Council. And frankly, what is often practiced today as the Novus Ordo Missae is really far afield of what the council called
for. What was intended, yeah.
Yes. However, there was a feeling among clergy and some lay people that the Second Vatican Council abrogated tradition. Now we don't have to deal with that anymore. We're in a new era. It's the age of Aquarius and everything's going to change. And maybe some of them had good intentions. Maybe they thought it was really going to work, and it didn't. And it didn't fill up the pews, and it didn't bring a lot of Protestants over, which was one of the goals. And it just didn't achieve the pastoral aims that many of them set out for. And so what do you do when something's not working? Maybe you try something else. Maybe you try something that's worked pretty well in the past. That's a reasonable thing to do. Mm-hmm. However, it became a fight over the council, at least in the minds of the radicals and the liberals. And it's totally ridiculous. You don't have to reject important parts of the Second Vatican Council in order to point out that felt banners and, you know, like lame guitar songs are not the most conducive to sanctity and reverence.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with Michael Knowles is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart. And be sure to subscribe. I don't want you to miss an episode. And it's free. And, of course, be on the lookout Friday for our episode of the Prayerful Posse. We talk about the bishop's immigration push, how practice is rewriting doctrine. And Father Jerry, Robert Royal, and I have a lot to say. Don't miss the Prayerful Posse. Go to Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube or wherever you get your podcasts. The U.S. bishops gathered this week for their annual fall meeting. They elected new leadership. They discussed immigration policy. And they talked about synodality a lot. With reaction to what transpired at this week's meeting in Baltimore, I'm joined by theologian and blogger Pat Nevy. Thank you so much for being here, Pat. You recently wrote a blog called Why is the USCCB Still Talking About Synodality? I want to start with a clip from the USCCB meeting featuring the papal nuncio, and then we'll work our way to your blog. Cardinal Christoph Pierre's address went this way.
I'm convinced that Vatican II remains the key to understanding what kind of church we are called to be today, and the reference point for discerning where we are headed. Pope Leo also is convinced of this. The Council's call to unity challenges us to resist the divisions that fractures our witness. Polarization, too, often allows Catholics, even within the same parish or family, to identify more with tribes and ideologies than with the body of Christ. The synodal path invites us to a different way, a style of being church that makes communion concrete allows dialogue to become discernment and Catholicity to become shared mission.
Patrick, lots going on in that clip, an obvious reference to the liturgy wars there with the polarization. But give me your thoughts on this idea that the synodal path and Pope Francis's vision is really the path to the future.
Well, I would love to agree with Cardinal Pierre. I really would. It seemed like synodality. I was just a lowly parish youth minister at the time, and I was excited about the synod because I was excited to meet with people from our community and talk to them about, you know, how we can better evangelize them and serve them. But as I wrote in my post, I think that the synodal path has failed in a degree. I don't want to throw the whole concept out, but. Well, mostly because I think one thing was that it was difficult to communicate it to allies. I think the communication to allies was done poorly. Very few people, even people who wanted to implement the synod well, didn't quite know what we were supposed to be listening for. But another big one was I think the synod was too quick to shun away potential allies who, you know, are Catholic and faithful to the Catholic Church. It seemed like those people who had questions about the synod, hey, is this going to be changing Catholic doctrine, were dismissed and poo-pooed. And unfortunately, it seemed like the only thing that was not allowed to be questioned, you could question anything you wanted in the Catholic faith except for synodality itself. And if you did question synodality, you were kind of seen as other. And so I think that dynamic that Cardinal Pierre is talking about, he's addressing this fracturing, this ideological fracturing in the church. But I don't think he realizes that the call might be coming from inside the house. There are things the bishops could be doing, and I hope that they do to heal those divisions, because a lot of the people who are upset by synodality that's being brought up again, or even the thing you're going to mention on immigration, they're upset by that, and the bishops could be the first ones to reach out to those folks and talk to them one to one and say, hey, this is what we're trying to do. Mm-hmm. How can we help you? What can we do to help assuage your concerns?
Yeah, Pat, I mean, look, as we've been very forthright about synodality and everybody talking and having a conversation, it's a wonderful thing. The problem is the form that synodality has taken is a choreographed elite exercise that excludes the only people in the pews. I mean, this is my biggest problem with this thing. It's not that everybody shouldn't get together and have a conversation. It's that it's a monologue. It's only people of like mind that are invited. And anybody else, as you said, are counted as other and worse, demonized. And those are the most faithful and zealous part of your faith. So I don't know what the exercise is intended to achieve at the end of the day. Is it to bring more people to Christ? Is it to enrich souls and help bring about conversions? If that's the case, I don't see the fruit of that.
Yeah, I think that was the third thing that I mentioned in my post was mm-hmm. that the stated objective was to bring people into the church and to have conversations with people who are not Catholic and see what they're looking for. And the form that took itself was ironic. Ironically didn't achieve that goal. What we did at my parish was we set up tables in the parish hall and we sent expensive letters out to every single household in the entire city, Catholic or not, and said, come here. And when you're listening to someone, like when you're a parent and you want to hear how your kid's day was, you know, you don't call them across the house and demand they come into your bedroom and sit down in your bed and let you know, you go to them and say, oh, hey, you know, Leo, I want to talk to you about your day. And so it was kind of an ironic, you said elitist. I think it was unintentional, but it was definitely perceived that way. You know, if I got a letter from the Lutheran church down the street, hey, we want you to come to our parish hall and tell us why you're not Lutheran, I would just ignore it. Like, if you want to come talk to me, come talk to me. I'm not going to go to a church I don't mm-hmm. belong to. And so I think the form itself, the intention, very great intention, the form itself needs some work. And also, I just think the brand of the term synodality is too worn out at this point to really revive.
Nobody knows what it means. Nobody knows what it means. It's like, you know, in a foreign tongue. Cardinal Pierre, as I mentioned, he references in that conversation he had with the bishops, recent controversies over the ban of the traditional Latin Mass in some dioceses. I mean, he doesn't directly speak to it, but it's obliquely referenced as polarization within parishes and tribes and ideology. You're a young parent. Your thoughts on the suggestion that tradition and traditional liturgies polarize a Catholic community. Is that what you're seeing?
Well, it just personally in my own community, my own area, our liturgy is tending towards the more traditional. A lot of the young families are more traditional. Mm-hmm. We have a traditional Latin Mass community. And I do think that, again, synodality would be a great thing to do here. I really do wish that bishops would go to these Latin Mass communities and have these conversations. I think the perception of traditional Catholics is very colored by what people see online. And oftentimes that's the only time a bishop will ever have an interaction with a traditional Latin Mass Catholic. And so they react accordingly, right? And what ends up happening is these very people are pushed out onto the margins, to the periphery, which at the beginning of Francis' papacy was a very important thing for him. He wanted to go out to the peripheries. And what we've been doing is we've been pushing faithful Catholics out to the peripheries. And I would imagine that if a bishop heard that was happening, he would say, hey, let's go out and get them and bring them back. But that doesn't seem to be happening in a few dioceses that will remain nameless. And I wonder why that's happening. It could be, there's two reasons. It could be they don't understand what they're doing. I would like to defer to that. But it could be an act of malice as well. And regardless of what it is, it's perceived as an act of malice. And so it's when you wrong someone, it's on your part. Like, you have a responsibility to go out and apologize. You can't wait for them to get with your program. That's not how relationships work.
Yeah, Pat, somewhere along the way, somebody bought the narrative that if you attend a Latin Mass or if you're a traditional pious Catholic, you're somehow part of a renegade anti-Vatican II operation, and that there are these two ideological camps at war. Their notion is stamp out the right, stamp out the practice, and you'll clear up the opposition. I don't understand this thinking, and I think it's fallacious and a stupid narrative to begin with. The USCCB fall meeting also had a presentation by the Migration Committee chairman, Bishop Mark Seitz of El Paso. And Seitz encouraged the bishops to support the migrant community affected by ICE raids and immigration enforcement. Watch.
As our late Holy Father Pope Francis so often reminded us, and as Pope Leo has strongly reiterated in these months of his papacy, acts of accompaniment are vitally important and integral to our shared mission of bringing hope and truth to a world desperately in need. Our immigrant brothers and sisters, from those who are undocumented to those who are naturalized citizens, are living in a deep state of fear. Many are too afraid to work, send their children to school, or avail themselves of the sacraments. And even those who continue to participate in daily life do so with a dark cloud hanging over them.
Patrick, your take on Seitz using the term accompaniment, and what do you make of the bishop's approach here?
But buzzwords aside, obviously, I think the bishops would do well. Again, the consistent theme across the board here is there's a call to stamp out ideology. And there's this encouragement from the people who need to hear, in the bishop's eyes, from the people that need to hear that. In this case, it's they're not saying it, but it's the right. The American right needs to stop being so ideological and get with the program. But the solution to an ideological fracture is not a top-down lecture. It is a conversation. And I think the bishops should look at the situation that we're in our country right now. Our president ran on a platform of mass deportation. He won the popular vote. It's a popular opinion that we need to do more deportations and quickly. And so instead of issuing statements, it would be good for the bishops to again ask why do people want this? What do they benefit if mass deportations happen? Why do they want this? What pain are they feeling that would bring them to this conclusion? And the bishops might be right. Those people might be right. But what we need is a humility in our church to have these disagreements and not make blanket statements. That's just my read, is that these statements tend to be very blanketed and then used to support ideological positions typically on the left.
Yeah, the focus of the document that they approved is entirely on, you know, these migrants who have come here. And look, I've met these people. I've been on the Rio Grande when they've come across. Your heart breaks for these people. They're obviously, you know, running toward a better life and trying to find a better way for their families. And in many cases, they're you know, they've been part of a cartel trafficking operation. But there's no mention in the bishop's comments about the criminal trafficking that these people often endure, the death of their human dignity in that moment, and even once they come here, when they're still working for the cartels in many cases, that's not mentioned at all, nor the distinction between, Patrick, a documented and an undocumented immigrant. They keep saying there's no difference. Well, yes, there is. One is acting in violation of U.S. law. The other is not. And I can't walk into the USCCB offices and pretend I'm running the joint, put my feet up on the desk. They will call the cops and throw me out. But there's this idea, and Cardinal Supich dropped a line into the document they approved this week, where they condemn the inhumane treatment of those deported without due process.
For us, this issue is not an abstract one. It's a personal one because we're pastors. We're pastors. We care about our people. And we care particularly for those who are most vulnerable, those who are most in need. That's just what the church ought to do and what it does. It's what we are called to do in the gospel. And I think you'll hear that from the bishops across the board. We all have people in our dioceses that are being swept up in this effort to go after people who are immigrants. And I say that in a very broad sense because although what the government has been saying is we're after criminals, it's extended much more broadly than that. And so while we certainly agree that people who are some kind of threat to our community ought to be taken off of our streets or, you know, once they're convicted, the sweep has taken up so many others and has the risk of setting aside any kind of due process.
Are these migrants here being subjected to an inhumane process?
Well, you know, I can't quite speak to that because I'm not part of the process. But from what I can see, I would imagine, you know, what processes do? Is it just simply you are here illegally, so steps need to be taken? Now, what I think is happening, though, why they're making this statement is deeper than the statement that they're making itself. I think there's a tendency in the church to want to be above the left-right paradigm, and I think the Catholic Church, in a deep respect, is above the left-right paradigm. But what that's caused in the church over the last couple of years is the church trying to find like the one pet issue to see, we disagree with both sides, and that side for the right is the immigration issue. And so I think that's why a lot of bishops are really digging in their heels about this. They want to seem bipartisan. But what ends up happening is, again, the statement is just going to be used by Catholics to bludgeon other Catholics. I think the statement is counterproductive to their stated goal, which is healing ideological division. They're speaking in universals, universal human dignity, you know, the care for the migrant, the welcoming of the stranger. They're speaking in these generalities, and then people can use those generalities to condemn specifics. I would prefer they speak in specifics. Say, this is an instance where something bad happened. This is an instance where something bad happened. And that's not happening.
Yeah. I would prefer that they speak holistically and honestly about what's happening, which includes criminality, violation of visa overstays, missing court dates, and the dignity of these migrants. In addition to, which got lost in all of this, the bishops and other leaders are asking for access to these immigrant detention facilities to share the sacraments, which is obviously a good thing. That's religious freedom. But that somehow gets lost in the political tussle over whether deportations are legal or not. They are. And the question is this inhumane treatment? I worry when that kind of language is used. And no one's saying they aren't our brothers and sisters. Everyone's our brothers and sister in Christ. But that doesn't confer universal citizenship of any one country upon us. And that's where I think this is all kind of getting lost. I got to move on here. The bishops voted this week for new leadership They elected to replace the outgoing USCCB president, Archbishop Timothy Broglio, with Archbishop Paul Coakley of Oklahoma City. I laughed when I saw that the AP was describing him as a cultural warrior. I mean, you know, any believing Christian is a cultural warrior to the AP at this point.
Sure. Yeah, I think if the AP doesn't like him, I like him immediately. I know great things about the Oklahoma City Archdiocese. I've heard great friends that have worked there and done a lot of good there. Just based on what I know about Archbishop Coakley, I think it's a great idea. And then also, given his deep traditional leanings, but also Oklahoma City, many people in this, is a hotbed for immigration. And so I think that's a good way. I think that's a good choice, not only for the bishops who make that their pet issue, but also the bishops who are more conservative and looking for more traditional liturgy. I think he can be a guy that builds a bridge between these two camps, these two ideological splits, because he can see both sides.
Yeah. Before we run out of time, I want to get your reaction to something that happened really in the middle of the meeting on the second day. The Bishops' Committee on Doctrine were presenting an issue, and at the end of that discussion, former Bishop of Tyler, Joseph Strickland, made an intervention, and he referenced the story of an openly gay ABC anchor, Gio Benitez, who publicly received a sacrament of confirmation at the hands of Father James Martin and a few others, with his husband at his side, present on the altar. I'll roll this for you.
I don't know how many of us have seen on the social media priests and others gathered celebrating the confirmation of a man living with a man openly, and it just needs to be addressed. Father James Martin once again involved, great pictures of all of them smiling. Here we are talking about doctrine. I just thought, I need to raise that issue. I know it's not part of any agenda, but this body gathered, we need to address it. Thank you.
Thank you, Bishop.
Your thoughts on the mixed messaging on doctrine here?
Yeah, I do think it was strange just from watching it, because I don't know how these meetings go. I couldn't tell if it was an open forum or, you know, why Bishop Strickland was standing up to talk about it and why they weren't addressing him. It does seem like he did it in a time that it wasn't allotted for. Now, again, that said, regardless, it's a bishop speaking to his brother bishops. I think that Bishop Strickland has placed himself in a tough position, because just obviously, I think everyone here agrees, you know, this needs to be addressed by the bishops. I think Father James Martin is doing what he's doing on purpose. He knows what he's doing. But I think Bishop Strickland has put himself in a tough position where he hasn't created enough of a coalition for his voice to be as strong in that room. I could see everybody when he got up and said social media, all the bishops are checking their phones. They're turning away. They don't want to be, you know, they're kind of getting secondhand embarrassment. And so as much as I think he was right, I think that some more work needs to be done by people who want to reprimand Father James Martin to build a coalition and say, like, okay, what are we going to do? You know, how is this hurting the church worldwide? How is this confusing people? But yeah, I did think it was strange to not even address him a little bit, even to say, you know, Bishop, thank you for your comment. This is not the time, you know, something like that.
Yeah, no, they sort of let it pass. But I'll tell you what his sin was. Bishop Strickland's sin in that gathering, and this is, look, I've been covering these things for 30 years. Thankfully, I haven't had to go in the last 8 or 9 years. But what I think is happening is he dared to speak in public. Most of this meeting now is done in private, Patrick. It's done off camera and off the scene. Frankly, I think the entire bishops' conference should be in private. You don't need the media there. There's no news really happening. This is stuff, these are reports and elections that can be released later. But the idea that Strickland voiced his opinion in public shows the discontinuity and the division among the bishops themselves. They don't like that. That's why certain journalists and individuals have sort of been poo-pooed from covering these things. Don't ask the wrong questions. You don't get invited back. I think it's become a non-news event. And though there are moments like this that you have to cover and that I do think are important, on the whole, there's not much news here. But Patrick Nevy, I thank you for being here, for helping us put this all in perspective. And you can find Patrick on X at Catholic Pat. Thanks, Pat.
Of course. Thank you, Raymond.
We have some sad news to report. As many of you are familiar with a frequent guest of this program, Sister Dee Dee Byrne, a physician, retired Army colonel, and superior of the Little Workers of the Sacred Heart. Well, Sister Dee Dee's mother, Mary Byrne, has passed away, and we pray for the repose of her soul. And our thoughts and prayers go out to Sister Dee Dee, her bishop brother, and their entire family at this difficult time. That is all the time we have for now, but be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thank you for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.